All right. Y'all ready? You good? All right. Thank you all. Thank you. Am I on all right? All right. Let's put the spurs to it. A joke real quick. Our studies are showing that a woman needs several things in her marriage. She's a man who really understands intimacy and connection and relationship. She's a man who's powerful and protective and aggressive in the relationship. And she needs a guy who's creative and adventurous. But mostly she needs to make sure that those three guys never meet, because see, that'd be really bad. It'd be a bad thing. Yeah. All right. So if you're in a dating relationship or am I not on? I think I'm. It's lit up. Hello? Test. Mute off, it says? Maybe that was, it's on mute. Is that me or you?
I'm not saying it's you, but it's not me. Okay.
Switch on top.
It might have, yeah. That's it.
Voila. How about that?
It's neither of us.
Yeah, it was neither of us. That's good. All right, so what I hope that you've been picking up as we've been talking is that if you're in a marriage or a dating relationship, welcome to the Struggling Humans Club. Let me tell you a little about our organization. For one thing, if you're not a member of our club, you're a member of another club, which I call the Liars Club. And as we said, marriage, relationship has to begin there, just like in our faith, with our, seeing our need for mercy and growth. Okay, that's where we have to start. And we talked about the four abilities, and we've talked about intimacy, but we said that the two most important pieces are intimacy and mutuality. So let's talk about the mutuality piece now. In other words, the second ability, which has to do with identity. Can I be me and can I let you be you and us work that out? All right, because mutuality is as important as intimacy. This sounds kind of loud and weird and funny to me right now. So somebody check that. Wait, would you look, take a look at it? It sounds kind of loud and echoey. Now, I noticed one of the questions that came up on the Google Voice was a good one about what does it mean, can I be me, can you be you, and asking me to unpack that a little more. That could actually be what this talk is about. In other words, what does it sound like to start to listen and to learn to read your own pulse? Can I be me means, and learn who I am means, do I know what I value? Do I have that to give to you right now? can I know when I disagree with you? Can I stand my ground when I disagree with you? Can I do that in a kind way that lets you matter too? There's a lot of questions about this whole second eye of identity that we could talk about. What I'm going to do instead, though, this morning, and we can do more of that in Q&A when we can, I want to talk about the issue of conflict and the potential of fighting, because if I am me and you are you, we're going to have some conflict. And so point number one is that's not necessarily bad. Conflict's not necessarily bad. Okay, conflict just happens, married or not, when you have a relationship with two people, both of whom have brains. Okay? Their billion-dollar government grants have revealed that relationships are always more difficult with two people in them. So legit conflict is just how two healthy people make sense of not being the same person. In other words, these couples that say, you know, oh, we never fight, then something's missing, okay? One of you is compliant, one of you is asleep, you're both compliers. I don't know, but that's going to diminish your relationship in some way. It's ultimately going to catch up with you. Alive people are going to have conflict. And we can resolve that, as I mentioned last night about forgiveness. And ultimately, it can create greater intimacy if we actually engage real me and real you and have conflict and resolve it. I was talking to a guy the other day who'd fallen in love with the perfect girl, and they'd been on all these dates, and I think this is the one, everything's wonderful, and but how can I know? And I said, I can tell you how you know. Pick a fight with her. He's like, what? We're so happy. I'm like, you got to fight with her. Pick a fight. Find something you can fight about. Fight about with her. Because you're not going to really understand intimacy, and you're not really understand your relationship with her until y'all have some conflict. Okay? Like the seraph says to Neo in The Matrix 2, how will you ever really know someone unless you fight them? Okay? He's right. All right? So conflict is not the problem here. Conflict shouldn't scare us. The real problem is this. You're trying to say something and they just won't get it. Or you feel like they're just really not letting you matter at all in the conflict. Or maybe you walk in and they've left their clothes on the floor again. Norma cleans up behind me. Like, I like to cook. And I like cut an onion and put my knife down to reach for the other onion. And I look and she's washed it and put it in the block, you know. I tease her that if I get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, she makes up my side of the bed, you know. Like, I'm coming right back, okay, you know. Or maybe you need them emotionally, or maybe you need them sexually and they blow you off. Or maybe they tell you how to drive, you know, the marriage killer. But instead of working through the problem or asking for what you need in an adult way, you get that fed up feeling and you snap or you jab or you say, you know what, I'm really sick of it. Really, we're going to do this. And that conflict starts to escalate. Or the other end, the room just gets icy. You know, like when the Dementors come in Harry Potter. It's just like, okay? And your hurt turns to anger or your fear turns to anger. As I said earlier, anger is a defense against a vulnerable feeling. So you hurt them, or you attack them, and they hurt back. And what was a conflict is now a fight. Okay? So point one, conflict, good. Point two, fight, not good. Okay? Fights and conflicts are different things. And I want to focus on fights first, because if a conflict can say a conflict, two people with a problem, we can solve that, all right? No big. We're going to talk about that. But once it becomes a fight, you ain't trying to solve anything anymore, Cinderella, okay? You're just hurt and you're angry and you're trying to win, all right? And old Mr. Problem that started the conflict that you got to resolve, he's sitting over there all sad and lonely all by himself because nobody's paying attention to him anymore because you're fighting, all right? That's why you've been having the same fight since college. So what I want to do today is deconstruct fighting and conflict. They're by definition these sort of like flowing complex dances filled with all this emotional reactivity. And I want to sort of slow them down like the Matrix, you know, and sort of pick them apart and understand what's happening and give you kind of some frontal lobe tools to use on these, by definition, reactive kind of events. And I want to get real practical on it and give you like steps. And that's going to be helpful because you'll need something very frontal lobe to help you when you're emotionally triggered, which we'll talk about. But you're also going to have to bear with me a little bit because with practical, there's the danger of coming off a little oversimplified because we are going to break it down into steps, you know. And this isn't going to be miracle cure. This isn't, you know, raise up your spouse in the way that she should go and when she is old, she will not depart from it. That's not what we're talking about here, okay? We're going to look at some themes and some principles and you're going to go, yeah, but what about, and I want you to do that because that's going to help us put meat on the bones in Q&A. Get it? All right. Another, by the way, I am assuming here in this talk, I mentioned yesterday, I'm assuming in this talk and in the whole conference, in essence, that both of you are repentant. Both of you are saying, hey, we're in a conflict and we're having a fight and let's try to figure out how to do this better together. As we said, if you're married to somebody who's like, yeah, we're fighting because you're not doing what I want you to do, get with it. That's an unrepentant person, and that's another show, but we'll address that some here, okay? But I'm going to assume you're both open to growing. So let's get started. Three parts. We're going to look at number one and two mostly. How to diffuse a fight, like once it starts, how do we put Humpty back together again? Number two, how do we swing back and address that old problem that started this whole thing in the first place? And do so in such a way that lets both of us matter. Mutuality is important as intimacy. And if we have time, we'll talk some about how to avoid a fight in the first place, but I doubt we'll have time for that. All right, so number one, what do we do when the fight bomb hits? Once you know it's kind of gone, once it's escalated, once you're saying what you always wanted to say, you know? Number one, I want you to go to timeout. Remember I mentioned this last night? You put your kids in timeout. You got some experience with this. Put yourself in timeout. Okay? That means somebody says, whoa, ow, God, that felt loaded. Let's take a break. Know where this is going to go is going to be helpful. Okay? Once you're gone, nothing you're going to say is going to help. It's where you say, God, that felt hurtful, and I'm about to be a jerk to you. Let's just stop. This is so super underused. I have so many couples that go, we sat there and fought for 4 hours. I'm like, ugh. And all the damage that gets done in there. Once you are triggered, we got to just kind of stop the madness, all right? Let me tell you why that's necessary. When you encounter hostility and frustration and anger and hurt, something happens in your brain. You start triggering your midbrain, your amygdala, your caveman brain, all right? It's like, you know, fight or flight or freeze, all right? Run from T-Rex or fight him. That's kind of the level of sophistication that's there, all right? So we criticize or we withdraw or we attack or we call names or we yell and scream or we become roommates. And that's kind of the tools of the trade with fight or flight, right? See which one of us wins, which one of us loses, which one of us is right. Does that sound familiar? Good, regular crowd again, all right? In other words, we do the same thing when we're triggered back here as we do with a Coke machine when it doesn't give us what we want, okay? In other words, what happens when you put the money in the Coke machine and no Coke drops? You start banging on it, right? Your aggression goes up. We get more violent, all right? And we call that a fight, all right? And that's a lot of fun till 1:30 in the morning, but strategically, what's the downside of a fight? A few problems that timeout is going to help. Number one, timeout is going to help stop the hurt that comes in a fight. All right? In a fight, you say things you don't mean. Okay? We're triggered in that reptile brain, that caveman brain. It's law of the jungle. It's eat what you kill. It's, you know, win at all costs. And that part of us is childish and destructive, and we got to stop him, all right? So timeout is like setting limits on a child, the child part of us, all right? In fact, I tell couples all the time, and if I could figure out how to draw on this again, I would do it. Nope, still don't know how. Should have learned during the break. I knew yesterday. I tell couples all the time, there's four people in your relationship. One of the most important things you need to know, there's four people in your relationship. There's you, and there's her, and there's your inner five-year-old, and there's her inner five-year-old, all right? Now, theoretically, you two adults get along just great. Y'all get along fine. But you say something, her inner five-year-old feels like you're going, what? You don't think I work hard enough around here? And she sends a message, just like that movie Inside Out. It's like, you know, it's like insult, insult, insult. He just put you down. He just compared you to his mother. You know, it's like alert, alert, alert. Now, adult her is like, fine. She knows you didn't mean that. But you're her inner little five-year-old person is like going, oh my gosh, you meant that and you don't really love me. And so now your little inner guy is going, what? And now the inner people, the little kid people are running the marriage. And in most cases, that's what's going on. We all bring that little inner undeveloped fragile, vulnerable, insecure child stuff to our relationship. Now, one of the coolest things you can do in your marriage is learn to talk about that and say, whoa, that just triggered, you know, little Joe. I'm freaking out now, you know. Now, I know you didn't mean that, but hey, you know, okay. We'll talk more about that in a minute. So, timeout kind of helps set limits on that child part. Second reason it's helpful is the goal of fighting is wrong, all right? And we need to stop you pursuing that goal. The goal of a conflict is both of us mattering, mutuality. But what is the goal of a fight? It's to win, right? Now, I don't want to be insensitive, but that's a terrible goal. I win and you lose? That's my goal here, really, okay? I mean, think about it. Best case scenario, I win. which means I'm married to a loser, all right? And the loser's not very happy. And the loser's going to come back and get me, bite me. They're going to win next time, all right? Think about how many win-lose relationships you know of in the universe that last very long, you know? Starbucks. You go to Starbucks and they're charging, you know, $22.50 for a cappuccino. You're not going to go back. So win for them, lose for you. You go to Starbucks and start stealing those cool, nifty mugs they have up in those little wooden shelves. That relationship's not going to last very long. Win-lose relationships don't work, all right? The playground principle being you can hit the kid with the ball, and that might get you the ball, but it won't get you anybody to throw it with, okay? So time out. Even if you don't know what to do good, don't do the bad. None of your solutions when you're triggered there are good ones. Now, by the way, time out is not a time out jerk face. Nor is time out silent treatment like, what? I'm just time out. One woman told me after a conference, she said, there's no way I'm using time out. That would just give him time to escape. He would love that. He'd go, yeah, sure, let's do timeout. And like 10 hours later, he'd still be at the 19th hole at the country club going, no, babe, I just need a little more timeout. Yeah. So you got to re-engage, all right? You can call timeout on yourself. You can go, hey, man, I need a moment. This is the fourth eye again, okay? But we got to just stop the bad. If you don't know what to do good, then just don't do the bad. Right? Okay? Let me be real honest with you here, though. I don't like going to timeout. it's like calling timeout on yourself or stopping in the midst, once somebody's triggered you, once somebody's hurt you, to not stay engaged, I don't like it. It hurts. It feels bad. Because it feels good to be a jerk. I don't know if y'all are the same way. In fact, this is a place I have trouble. In that moment, I want to be mean. In that moment, I want my finger in her face. And I'll tell you this, if you take time out, if you set limits on that mean part of you, it will feel bad. You will want to get one last jab in on your way out of the room. Okay? Here's why. It literally does feel good to be mean. Because psychologically speaking, what it does is shame and hurt and cruelty is a commodity. There's an amount of it inside of us. And if I dump some of it on you, I literally have less inside. That's why it feels good to hold a grudge. I keep that person bad and I keep feeling good. If I hurt you, I feel better because I've made you feel worse. We've actually deposited some of it on you, okay? And we got to stop that part of us. But if you do, you'll be left with your anger, cruelty, helplessness, and garbage inside of you. And that's going to feel bad. Now, over the time out, as you drop in your levels of adrenaline and all that and are able to go more frontal lobe, you're going to be able to metabolize that pain. But initially, it's going to sting. I'm just going to let you know that. You're not going to want to do this, which is why people don't do it and not why they fight for 4 hours, okay? But I want you to have this in your frontal lobe, okay? You can also do timeout on your spouse. If they're being unkind, Norma said to me, not long ago, we were having a little conflict. I said something. She goes, did you mean that to be mean? She said, I mean, because we were having an altercation, albeit an unpleasant one, but that felt like a jab. That felt like you were trying to hurt me. Were you trying to hurt me? Because I really don't think I want to keep talking if you are wanting to hurt me. Now, suddenly, I was left with a very interesting options. What a beautiful, perfect limit on a jerky person. She didn't go, oh my gosh, I can't believe you talked to me like that. She goes, whoa, wait, goes bird's eye. Was that mean? Because no, I don't think I want to do mean. And all of a sudden, a good limit notice is never a rule about me, about the other person. It's a rule about me. She was making a rule about her. She wasn't saying, quit being mean. She said, if you're going to be mean, I don't think I want to talk anymore. That's a perfect limit. And I had to grow up. Okay? That kind of time out. Remember I told you last night, jerky people need a limit set on us. It's the only way we grow, all right? Third reason that we need time out is, that was a minute ago. is it gives us time to think. In other words, you're triggered back here in your amygdala. Frontal lobes are like going to sleep, man. Nothing's happening. And we literally need to slow down to get that fourth eye going, to be able to observe what we're feeling. The only thing that's going to work us out of a fight or work us out of a conflict is for us to think. We got to move up here to our frontal lobes and start solving problems. What am I needing? What am I, why am I hurting? What is going on here? What do we need? And sometimes that takes 20 minutes physiologically for that to happen. All right? And timeout's going to give us that so we can play golf, not tennis. Because we are smart up here, we're dumb back here. All right? But this is where we live in a fight. So stop and think. You know how Obi-Wan says to Luke, Luke, trust your feelings. All right? Obi-Wan's wrong. All right? He's wrong. Honestly, trust your feelings. You're crying out loud. You know? That's why he lived in the desert of Tatooine all by himself. You can't maintain a relationship with a woman thinking like that. You know? Come on. So, time out. Hit the kill switch. Super underused. Now let's use those frontal lobes. What are they going to give us? This will sound familiar from last night. We got to go bird's eye. Like we said, marriage problems aren't linear cause-effect. They're cyclical. And it creates a dance. And one of the most powerful things you can do to intervene in your conflicts or your issues or your patterns in your marriage or your dating is to know your dances. All right? Back up and say, what are we doing? Why are we doing that? Like I told you last night, some of the value of therapy, even if your therapist is a bird brain, is somebody objective to stand outside your system and look back at it. Most of us as couples can't do that. So Norm and I used to have the same habitual fight. We call it ultimately the whose day's worse war. And that is, I would come in from work exhausted, slumped over with my computer case and my coat, assuming I had a bad day position, hoping that will evoke some pity and appreciation. Problem is, the source of my adoration is blankly slumped over the stove somewhere, cooking something I don't like for dinner. And her response is, hey, could you help set the table? As if to say, welcome back from your 8-hour vacation again. And I go, well, I'm really tired. I think I just want to sit down a minute, which is sort of my way of saying, look, I've been helping people all day. You know, you've just been driving around in a minivan, you know? And the war becomes, you know, who's going to be appreciated here? And how many times do you have to have that war, you know? So bird's eye is at some point we back up and we go, whoa, wow, what are we doing here? I'm being all pitiful, and I want you to appreciate me. I'm certainly not going to ask for what I need. And you were feeling like, I don't get all you do with the kids and the plumber and the bills and all. And who's going to win? Here we are. We're doing that thing again. Hear the bird's eye? I'm observing this some. So bird's eye is going to ask two questions. What are we doing? What's this dance? What are we needing? What are we doing over and over again? And what am I doing? So first, I just mentioned, me and Nora, back up. Do you care about how hard I work? I'm playing this game. You're playing it back. What are we doing? We look at the us. We sort of sit in the line judge tennis chair and watch the game rather than being in it. All right? Key word there. You hear me keep using we. You hear it? What are we doing? Fights are you. No, you. No, you. Bird's eye, we back up and start talking about we, all right? We covered some of this stuff last night, so I'm not going to go back over it. Just so we'll have more time for questions. All right, now the hard one. That's what are we doing. This is what I love. This one's gold. What's going on with me? What am I doing? Bird's eye on myself. You know that sense when you're in a fight and it's gotten way bigger than it ought to have gotten? You know, that's that sense that 2 + 2 = 7. Okay, I want you asking, where did that other 3 come from? Dang, all right. Maybe it's a way you've wounded me in the past and never gotten resolved. Or maybe it's a way you keep chronically wounding me and I'm fed up. Or maybe it's developmental. Maybe it's my own history. Maybe this has nothing to do with you. Maybe this is something I brought with me in the relationship. All right. I call these legacy hurts or legacy triggers, and they just sit in the background of us until we disagree about car insurance or something, and then boom, you know, Hiroshima, all right? So Norma wrote a book years back about Camp DeSoto. Do y'all know Camp DeSoto? Got some DeSoto girls here? All right. Her grandmother started it, so she wrote a book about it. And she asked me to edit one of the pages of one of the chapters of the book, which I did. And so I came back in one day and I said, I finished. I made some recommendations and some thoughts, and here you go. And she goes, yeah. Well, thanks. I immediately am like, thanks. I didn't say that, but I'm like, hey. Like, that's all I get. That's your reaction to me. Not only that I spent the time doing it, but this is my wisdom here. This is all, I've given you a great gift, okay? And so I realized, man, that just really made me mad. All right, time out, not gonna say anything, you know, just don't know what to do good, just don't do the bad. So I sort of back off. She's like, are you okay? And I'm like, no, but I hadn't figured it out yet. All right, so I start doing this. What is my deal? Like, what is this meaning? And all of a sudden, I figured it out. It was parent stuff. It was like, oh my gosh, look at my grades. Didn't I do good? And it was like, you know, the sort of, yeah, but there's a B here, son. That kind of phenomenon, you know? And that got triggered by her. And so I said, I figured it out. She said, what? I said, well, yeah, I am upset, but not at you. I think it's at my mom. All right, this has nothing to do with you. All right? So let me work that out with her, but I'm not going to do it to you. All right, you have a responsibility to do that, to not bring that garbage to your spouse. It's not their fault, okay? Now, in order to do that, you're going to have to time out. You're going to have some frontal lobes happening, and you have to go a little bird's eye on yourself. You got to do that, all right? Again, if you can't do that yourself, get some external eyes to help you. That's where you ask your safe people or your therapist, whomever. Man, I popped off at my wife the other night, and I don't know why it triggered me so much. What's the deal? There is a reason, right? All right, time out. Bird's eye, number three. This is going to be key. As we said, one of the key differences between a conflict and a fight has to do with hurt. Oh, my daughter Callie just texted me. Let's see what she says. She wishes she was here. Me too. One of the key differences between a conflict and a fight is that you get hurt in fights, all right? We gotta fix that, or else we're not gonna go anywhere. Now, what is hurt? You hurt me. Take a stab at what that, put some words on that. What does that mean? You hurt me. Like a criticism. Okay? What else is a hurt?
Rejection.
A rejection. Hurt feels like you've rejected me. Okay, yeah.
Not being acknowledged.
Like not seeing put down. All right, a theme for these, I think, hurt usually involves some kind of a diminishment. You know? I share my heart, you blow me off. You see my sin, you attack me about it, or put me down about it. You're somehow making me less, you're wounding me in some way. Somebody's hurtful to me at a party and you just ignore it passively, you don't have my back. You felt I'm diminished, you've made me less than in some way. Now, secret of the universe, as we alluded to last night about the ordeal, a huge reason people have trouble resolving conflict and making it end good is not poor communication skills or not knowing your love language. It's because most humans do not know how to repair hurt once they've caused it. In other words, I hurt you all the time, but none of us know how to make hurt resolve. So that hurt just stays. It's like if you could never take the garbage out. Pretty soon you'd want to move out of your house, all right? So we're going to talk about how to take the garbage out. The problem is, once you've hurt them, you've changed the dynamic. Now you don't just have one problem, conflict. Now you don't just have two problems, conflicts turn into a fight. You got three problems. Now the fight has hurt somebody. And the conflict, original conflict and problem is so far back there, you forget what's going on about them, all right? And until you solve that problem, until you solve that hurt, I mean, you ain't going nowhere, boy. All right? Because now the issue is not about the problem. It's about the hurt. Okay? So let me ask you again, if you're hurt, what do you need? What would make it feel better? Isn't it interesting that these are hard questions to answer?
I feel like when you're hurt, you just want to be heard.
Yeah.
You want to be fixed.
Perfect. Let's just land with that. I want to be heard, not fixed.
Acknowledged.
Exactly. Understanding, acknowledged, hearing. I'm going to explain to you how that works. Because it is the only thing that's going to make it better if you're hurt. I have got to be heard. I've got to get a sense that you see how I'm hurt and you care about it and you get it. Okay? If you don't, they're going to hold on to it forever. They're going to bring it up years later, you know? You know, it's like that time on our honeymoon. You're like, oh my gosh, you know? That will happen unless we are understood. Now, this is not complicated. We do it all the time in everyday life. You're driving down the interstate and some idiot cuts you off and you go, oh my gosh, what an idiot. But then you kind of see through the back window that he sort of looks in his rearview mirror and kind of waves like that. And it's like, you go, oh, okay, he knows he's an idiot. Yeah. See you, man. What is that? What happened? He gives that little look like, yeah, dude, sorry. I mean, I kind of almost killed us both. And we're good. We're friends. All right? All right, that's psychology in action. All right? Because what we need is a rear view mirror wave in your marriage. All right? In other words, why that feels good is because the guy got it that he almost killed us both. And he got it that I'd be mad at him. He got it. All right? Now, you got to do that in a marriage to heal the hurt, okay? That we need to have a sense that at some level, from their perspective, we can try to get it why they would be upset, all right? That's valid in some way. This is where we get the psychobabble term validation, okay? This is because I see there's some validity to what you're saying. If I try it on in your shoes, all right? Now, this does not mean you agree. We're not throwing the match. We're not taking a dive in the fifth. It just means that right now, while it's your turn, I'm going to try on what your hurt feels like and sounds like until you understand that I get it. It's the only way out of this box. I'll tell you a story. Norma has various little minor medical problems and needs a doctor to give her prescriptions and all that. And her doctor moved away. So she says, you know, I work at the hospital. And she said, who do you think I ought to see? I said, that's easy, Dr. Whitney. She's so cool. She parked, we park near each other in a doctor's parking and we'll walk in the doctor's lounge, eat breakfast or whatever. I just see her all the time and she's just dynamite. She's super cool, like young 40s, she'd be great. So she's like, great. So she calls her and she can't get in till like, you know, next June. And she's like, I can't get in with Dr. Whitney. And I'm like, well, I'll see her in the doctor's parking. I'll ask her. So like 2 weeks goes by and I never see her. Norma says, I need, my prescriptions are running out, I need a new doctor. And I'm like, okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to stalk her. I'm going to go to the doctor's parking early, like with a granola bar and some orange juice, and I'm going to just park. Because I know where she parks. We always park near each other. And I'm just going to sit there. And when she gets out of her car, I'll get out too, and I'll ask her. So I get to the parking lot about 7:30, and I sit there and listen to public radio and eat my granola bar and wait like 25 minutes, and then up pulls Dr. Whitney. And I get out of my car, I'm like, oh, Dr. Whitney, hey, what a funny seeing you here this morning. Wow, I was just needing to talk to you. Look, my wife needs a doctor. She's like, no problem, call this girl at my office and tell her. Norma gets in the next week, all right? So the next week comes and goes, and I see, Norma and I are out to dinner, and I'm like, oh my gosh, it's Tuesday, you saw Dr. Whitney today. How'd it go? She goes, oh, I loved her. She was great. And she loved that story about you stalking her in the parking lot. I said, you told her that? She's like, oh, yeah, she thought it was so cute. I literally timed out. I literally walked, I got up from the table and had to leave because I was going to do something bad. I was so humiliated. I said, A, that was not your story to tell. Okay? B, I do not want her to think it was so cute and sweet. I want her to think I'm like cool Dr. Cox, one of her colleagues. I'm not some creepy husband who's going to stalk her in the car. I was actually driving the minivan that day. I'm the creep in the minivan. So anyway, Norman's like, oh, well, okay, I'm sorry. Okay. So anyway, I go back to work, and I keep running to Dr. Whitney, and I'm like hiding. I'm like ashamed to see her. I don't want to see her. I'm embarrassed. And this goes on, and after like a month or two, I'm realizing I'm still embarrassed to run to Dr. Whitney. I don't want to see her. And I thought, I need something from Norma. And I sat her down and I said, look, I'm really still hooked by the Whitney story. And I need you to get it. And I told her, I said, that was really embarrassing to me. I went out on a limb for you. I husbanded you. I cared for you. I stalked her for you. And you threw me under the minivan. Not the bus, the minivan. That was embarrassing. That was not your story to tell. And she got it. She goes, I completely get it. You don't want her to just think you're some cute husband. You're a colleague. And you don't want her, that would feel terrible. Her thinking you know, or a cute husband who stalked her, that'd feel terrible. And it's like I just felt it let go. And the embarrassment, the shame about seeing Dr. Whitney melted away, I got gotten. It's the only way that we ever let go of that kind of hurt. My anger at Norma melted. She got it. She heard me. She cared that it hurt me. All right? Now, that's simple, right? But why might it be hard to do? Why might it be hard for Norma to do that? And this is key. I'll tell you, I don't know about you, but the reason I hate doing that, just hearing you, is that it gets dangerously close to agreeing that I'm just the bad guy. But there's not two sides to the story. If I'm just going to hear you, it really is getting really close to Norma saying, it's my fault, I'm a terrible person. Wow, John, you were really a horrible victim of my evil scheme. I can't believe you had to go through that, you know? It gets really close to her being the bad guy. And nobody's going to do that. And nobody should. A, because it'd feel awful. B, because it's not the truth. We haven't heard the whole truth here. We've just heard John's side of the story. In other words, I've been gotten, but you haven't. All right? So what's going to happen is you're ultimately going to feel like the bad guy, which is going to make you then turn the tables and push back on me because you don't want to be the bad guy. And we're back to bad guy hot potato and blame again. And in order to avoid that, we've got to use a very sophisticated psychological technique. Taking turns. Okay? In other words, after she's heard me, Norma gets a turn. Okay? If you're going to resolve hurt, you're going to have to go do a timeout. You're going to have to go bird's eye. You're going to have to back up and take turns. Norma and I do this all the time. We will say, okay, I went first last time. You go first this time. What is it you need to be understood here? Instead of what a fight is no, you don't. I want you to see. No, I see that. Why don't you? And we're fighting to be understood. We're slowing it down to say, okay, let's stop the fighting. You need something here, and you have a turn too. All right? So after Norma hears me, I'm going to say to her, or she's going to say, does he need anything else? Can I have a turn? Or better yet, I'm going to say, is there anything you need? And she's going to say, well, as a matter of fact, there is. To tell you the truth, I feel like you kind of gave me and my comment to Dr. Whitney way too much power. In other words, you had some feelings about this that made you feel shame, and you're kind of bashing me for it. I mean, can you own that some of this reaction you had about her is yours? I mean, maybe you want her to think you're real cool. And I said, yeah, you're right. I made this a huge deal. And a lot of it was my shame. A lot of it was my narcissism. I want her to think I'm awesome, cool, not a stalker husband. That's my shame. And that really upset me and triggered me, and I really freaked out on you about it. Good point. Okay? We both matter here. Mutuality. It's the only way we get past it. All right? I like that better than saying I'm sorry, by the way. I'm sorry is kind of like kissing your sister. You know, it's like, hey, I'm really sorry about it, aren't you? No, I want you to talk to me about how you hurt me. You want to really help someone heal, don't say I'm sorry. Say, I really took something from you in that, didn't I? That really cost you this, and you show them you get it, and that's caviar, man. All right. So, healing, hears, hurts. The three H's. All right, final step. The good news is we've kind of gotten past the hurt. Bad news is we still hadn't solved the problem. Remember the one we began this whole thing in the first place? Well, here's the target. We said every fight is hopeless. Why? Because it is a win-lose. Well, buckaroos and buckarettes, we got to have a win-win. All right? That means you can't bully to get your way. You can't pull the submission card. You know, the one that says tie goes to the husband? Mm-mm. You got to both matter here. All right? Another thing I call this is matter. All right? The goal is mutuality, not winning. It's the only way to have a good relationship. What that means is what your spouse wants or needs has got to matter in the solution as much as yours. Okay? And that's not always going to be what you want. But the day you said, I do, one of the things you said, I do to was, do you agree to not let what you want be the only thing that matters from now on in your life? And you said, I do. All right? Good news, though, your spouse did too. Our family used to have an annual fight because we had three girls and we're from the South, which means we did Christmas card pictures. Right? Now, with three girls, we'd take 600-700 pictures, you know, and, you know, the huge. And the girls would go through them and pick them, you know. And, you know, usually there would be a lot of conflict. But one year, they absolutely could not find one. You know, we found lots of pictures that two of them liked, but there was always one of them who'd be like, no, my hair is poofy. You know, so they couldn't find a picture. And we told them, look, either you guys got to land on the picture that you want or we're going to pick it, which is, you know, fate worse than death. And so they picked one, and all that could be said about this picture was that nobody hated it. It actually wasn't the best picture. But they compromised, all right? And upon realizing this, Callie, who at that time was 17, the therapist now, she said, oh, I get it. Compromise is where everyone is equally unhappy. She said, if I got my pick, at least somebody in the house, a third of us, would be happy. Nobody's happy now. Am I right? That's the goal in marriage, is for everyone to be mutually unhappy. Yes. My clients love it. It's like, thanks, Doc. Now we're both unhappy. You know? But seriously, win-win is not a solution. It's a commitment. Okay? Get me on this. Win-win, we're going to work toward a win-win as a covenant. It's like the Marines, no one left behind, all right? What win-win means is I can trust in the marriage that you will work to let me matter, all right? One of the reasons we fight is that we're scared. In other words, one of the reasons we fight is I'm afraid that if I don't fight you, that you will not let me matter and under the bus I go. So I got to stay on top of you and push back harder. If I let go of the reins a moment, you will take what you want. I know you will. I know you. Okay? And we live in that position, and it's one of the reasons we fight, because we don't trust that a covenant that says, I will not do something and just steamroll over you. Okay? Win-win says, you know, I want Chinese and you want Mexican. Win-lose says, well, how can I win and get my mooshu pork, okay? Win-win says, what we know is not going to happen is I'm going to get Mexican tough on you or you're going to get Chinese tough on me. Maybe we're going to do something. Maybe we'll go get Mexican and get you Chinese takeout, okay? Maybe we'll go to Chili's and get a Southwestern egg roll. I don't know. But we will do something to where this works, all right? I saw a couple a while back, and he had a pretty good job and wanted to quit it and go to med school. And she had a pretty good job and wanted to quit it and have babies. All right? So what did his med school dreams mean to her baby dreams? What did her baby dreams mean to his med school dreams? Welcome to every marriage I know. All right? And they knew it. Who's going to win? Who's going to lose? Who's going to get left out to dry? And they were scared, and they fought a lot about it. We started talking about win-win. And sort of this issue of what's not going to happen is somebody's just going to die on the vine. And you could see them sort of settle down, and then they started getting creative. It was cool to watch. Once they were no longer afraid and having to kind of defend their territory, they started getting creative. He started thinking about nurse prac school instead of full-on physician. She had some family investments they dug around in and thought about redoing them so maybe she could still quit her job and have babies, and he could do, you know, they start getting creative, all right? But the best thing was they stopped fighting, okay? What we're talking about now is a problem, not a fight, and that's what marriages are for, solving problems. You think I'm too hard on the kids? I think you're too soft. Okay, good. Let's get a third party. Let's see a counselor. Let's get a marriage, a parenting book. Let's both get uncomfortable. You think we spend too much? I think we save too much. Let's both get uncomfortable. All right? You want to talk about our issue right now, late at night? I don't want to. Tell you what, we talk about it tomorrow. I promise I'll be the one to initiate it. We work to take care of each other in that. That's mutuality. All right? Now, I'm going to stop there because I want plenty of time to do questions and thoughts. And I want the rest of our time to do that. Are y'all desperate for a break, or can you sneak out if you need to? Why don't you sneak out if you need to, and let's stay here and do Q&A. I'm going to do one of these Google Voice questions. This is an interesting one. How does the role of man as head of the household fit into this? As we're describing two equal people, two equal parts. I love this question. I'm going to just extrapolate from there. What do we believe about headship, submission, all of that? Well, I think one thing we know is that leadership does not mean that the man gets what he wants. Okay. In fact, if you look at when Jesus talks to the disciples about leadership, I forget where it is. I think it's somewhere in John. Where is it where the disciples, they're arguing about who's going to sit at his right hand and who's going to...
Mark 10.
Mark 10. I knew it was in Mark. And they're like wanting this position of leadership and authority. And he goes, no, 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 no. He goes, this is not like the Gentiles where you lord it over them. Because in my world, leadership means being, you know, the least shall be the greatest. In other words, what a leadership means in God's economy is not who gets to sit at the right hand. It's who goes to Golgotha first. Okay? Leadership is not getting what I want. You know, we're not getting the drapes done because I'm the head of the house. Or, hey, somebody's got to be the tiebreaker. You know, yeah, I've had that twice in 35 years of marriage. Not a real big topic. Win-win will almost always work. Leadership is about initiating a worldview. Leadership is about saying, this is how I want our house to be. And we have a lot of growing to do, and I'm going to lead the pack on this. And I want to learn about so-and-so. I want to learn about... One of the reasons that Paul calls women to submit is not because submission is the most important thing in a marriage. It's because submission is an inclination that Paul needs to remind you about. Who do you think it is who stops me most often in the hall at church to ask me a parenting question or a marriage question? Who does that? Do you think it's husbands? No, it's wives. Wives are constantly initiating. Hey, John Cox, can I ask you something real quick? What's a good marriage book that me and my husband could read? Is it the husband's? Paul's going, hey, girlfriend, back off a little bit. Back down. The dude's got to initiate. All right? Now, if he doesn't, if he's passive, we got a lot of problems. But if you're asking what leadership means is, leadership means, okay, I want us to go think about some of this stuff Cox was talking about, because I think this is really important stuff for our relationship. Initiating means you're proactive. Think about how often that's reversed. That's why Paul is always saying, hey guys, this isn't because it's the most important thing in the marriage for you to lead and him to submit or her to submit. It's because he knows we struggle there. Dudes are slackers. We're slackers in this. And women are just really glad to pick up that ball and run it in the end zone and spike it and do the dance and all that. And he's going, no, 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 girl, put the ball back down. You got to chill, okay? Let him initiate. Let him lead. Now, the curses set us up for this. God says, guys, your initiating in the world is going to hurt. It's going to be sweat of the brow. You're going to be exhausted when you come home. And your wife's going to meet you at the door with a broken water heater. And you're going to want to either become a controlling jerk or just abdicate. Don't do that. Lead her like Christ leads the church. Get back in there. And ladies, you're going to, there's some writers who believe that the curse to woman, your desire will be for your husband, but he will rule over you. That the word desire there is the same word that's used later on when God is talking to Cain and says, sin's desire is for you. It's crouching at the door, but you must master it. In other words, it's the same word. It means to control or to take over. And part of the curse is this inclination a woman's going to have to push you and to say, I think you need to go talk to your boss again and get us more money. That sort of push thing. He needs to be going, ladies, be careful about that. Be careful about that. I'm not a Greek scholar, so I'm not sure about what I just said, but I just thought it was interesting. Seriously, I'll stay in this is my topic, you know. But you're asking a biblical question about leadership and submission. So leadership, I think, is about initiating. It's about saying, I want us to learn more about this. Here's why I don't think I'm good. Let's sit down and talk about this, because that's not what we do. Our wives are going to be the ones to say, well, I think we should get our notes from John Cox's thing and talk. That's what's going to happen, right? So Paul says, don't let that be what happens. Be the leader. Initiate it. This is your baby. Okay? All right. That was one of the questions on here. Great question. Field question? I'll try to alternate. Yes, sir, in the back.
So you talked about, I think you said, you mentioned you had two examples where you were doing win-win mutuality and you couldn't quite maybe come to like a creative solution.
Yeah.
What do you do if you're trying to go through that exercise? You're trying to find creative solutions, but the two desires seem mutually exclusive.
Well, I was talking to one of my old seminary professors about that very topic not long ago. And he was saying it actually happened when he was being considered to a call to come to RTS Jackson. And he really wanted to do it. He really felt called to do it. And his wife was like, absolutely not. I don't want to move to Jackson, Mississippi. Absolutely not. All right, so what do you do there? You pull the old leadership submission card? Is that when you use it? He said, a good leader is like a good CEO. And his wife is the board of directors. And he goes, I think we ought to sell the company. And the board of directors goes, no, not a good idea. He doesn't say, sorry guys, I'm the CEO. He goes, wow, well, you guys are all really smart. I really want to consider that. Let's pray about this some more. Let's ask more counsel. Let's learn. Maybe let's not do it now. And it's just very, 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 very rare that it's like, we got to pull the trigger today and I'm going to do it. If you reach a stalemate that's that big with the person you trust and love the most, I'm going to listen to them. If I'm leader, I get to pick the system of government, right? Well, I pick that it's not a monarchy. I pick that it's a mutually helpful, you talk to me, I talk to you, whatever that system of government's called, you know. a grand duchy, like at The Hague. I don't know. What is that? You know. So that's what I would do. I'd let it be messy for a while. Okay? I trust my wife. She's smarter than me. By the way, think about that. Another issue about leadership and submission. You got to go back to Genesis to understand those things, I believe. And what is Eve's job description in Genesis? I will make a helper suitable for him. The word helper is only used about one other person, Eve, and who else in the Old Testament? Exactly. In other words, he's saying, I'm going to give to you, Adam. Poor Adam, you need help. Not, dude, Adam, the leader, you're awesome. You're Iron Man, and she's Pepper Potts. No, it's like, dude, you need help. I'm going to give to you someone who will have a role for you like God has over Israel. It's that bad, all right? In other words, that's who Eve was. Now, I want to listen to her. God says you need help. I don't need help in English. I don't need help in psychology. I need help in math. And when somebody's going to teach me math, I'm going to listen to them. So, I don't know. Let me do one out of here. this is a good one. How do I handle playing golf while she's playing tennis? Difficult when I'm the doormat and trying to stand up for myself. Okay, that's a good question, and I would categorize that under limit setting. In other words, a good limit is always a rule for me, okay? And good time out is always a rule for me. And that is, if she pops off with some sharp comment, I'm not going to either go, oh, okay, yes, dear, nor am I going to go, oh my gosh, you're such a so-and-so, all right? I'm going to want to set loving limits, loving, powerful, godly limits. Now, what that means is I need some time to think about what you're saying because it really feels a little sharp. That felt really loaded. Well, it is loaded because you're just, whoa. I'm going to need to leave the room if you're going to keep coming at me, or you can let me just sit here, or I'll go upstairs. Your choice. I'm making rules for me here, see? I'm not telling her, shut up. I'm saying, I'm not going to talk. Now, I don't care if she keeps lobbing tennis balls at you all night. If she keeps lobbing them, I'm going to go upstairs. If she starts banging on the door to try to bang it down, I'm going to leave the house and go sit in the car and roll the windows up. And if she starts banging on the car, I'm going to try to back out. And if she stands behind the car, I'm going to call the police. We can take this as far as you want. I'm telling you real stories because I have a lot of women in my office who say, my husband just wants to yell and scream at me. And I'm like, well, settle him and say, I'm not going to talk. I'm going to go in the next room. Well, then he would come and bang the door down. And I'm like, go get in the car. Well, he would stand behind the car. I'm like, you're obviously describing a situation in which this person is going to actually violently restrain you. Call the cops. Call the pastor. I have a great one. This woman has a husband who screams and yells at her. And what she did was, she, with his permission actually, he's somewhat repentant, she got a phone relationship with his best friend and said, when he goes off and starts screaming, can I call you? And just hold the phone up. And if you don't want to answer or whatever, just let go to voicemail. We'll have a really juicy voicemail of him screaming and calling her every name in the book. And it's been amazing how that accountability has helped him. All right? So I'm not saying quit screaming. I'm saying you scream all you want. But being a bully only works in secret. And I'm going to bring in third parties that are going to create accountability for you. And I'm going to make sure that your best friend hears this and your best friend's committed to this. And you can see this guy settle down. So whoever you're married to, the tennis player, then you set a limit to say, I'm not ready to talk again on this. And if they keep throwing tennis balls, set a better limit. If you're in the victim role in a relationship, it is your responsibility to stop using he, she language. Oh my gosh, she's blah, blah, blah. And start asking, how can I grow to be a person who can handle difficult people better? That's the real question. Okay? That's an art form. All right, that was in here. Let's go back out. Yes, ma'am.
So, kind of, I guess, piggybacking off of that, can you talk a little more about like a timeout versus silent treatment, or if one person perceives, I don't want to talk right now, or, you know, that you're trying to process something and they're going, I don't want to talk to you because you're giving me the silent treatment all night. Can you kind of unpack that a little bit more?
Yeah. I think you all know the vibe of silent treatment, and you can feel the difference in silent treatment and timeout. In other words, timeout needs to be a little bit more of a deliberate tool, and I'm going to say, I need to be quiet a little bit because I really am triggered and I don't know what to say, and probably if I say anything it's going to be ugly, and so I'm going to need to be quiet. And I'm saying that in a way that says, look, we got a problem to solve together and here's kind of where I am about that. Silent treatment very loudly has that vibe of, why does silent treatment hook us? I'll tell you my theory. Is silent treatment implies shame. In other words, you are so disgusting to me that I'm not even wanting to talk to you. Okay? And so there's this very loud shaming that says, you don't get me. And I want to go, no, please, anything but that. You're not going to talk? But it does have this loud message of, you are so bad that I'm not going to talk to you. Now, that is a hostile thing. Now, what I want to do if I'm the victim of silent treatment is, I'm not really sure what's going on. Remember, I've got to ask myself, what's a good limit for me? I can't go, oh my gosh, you're silent treating me again. I want to say, I'm not sure what's going on, but this feels like there's a lot going on feels hostile, feels angry. I want to let you know that I am open to trying to address whatever question you have or whatever issue you want to talk about. And I'm going to leave that in your court. You let me know. Otherwise, since you're not saying anything, I'm going to assume we're hunky-dory and everything's super. I'm going to go, you know, watch TV. And I'm in essence saying your silent treatment is not going to work on me, and I'm going to give you responsibility to initiate, to solve this problem that you're silently punishing me about. Otherwise, I'm like cooling the gang, right? So there's a vibe difference between the two, between silent treatment and timeout, because timeout is a deliberate tool that I'm going to talk to her about. I'm going to say, I still need to not talk. I'm still really... amped up. I'm still real caveman. I kind of need to settle down. May even need to talk to some friends before I do, but we'll get back together. It's a tool. Okay? Feel the difference?
Do you think it would be helpful to say, we will revisit this at this time?
Yes.
Because I know, I can be like, I need a boundary. I know I'm feeling angry and I'm going to say ugly things, but I know Wade will find me saying this. Then you'd be like, okay, I think you're being punitive. I do know he doesn't want space because that makes him feel nervous. But so I think in the past I have used a boundary to punish or to do a silent treatment thing. But so if I could do that, but then we could say, but I promise we'll revisit this at this time and I will initiate that. So that you know I'm not just saying...
That's beautiful and kind. In other words, you know that he is going to get triggered by the pull away thing. So you're going ahead and hedging his bets and saying, I am going to pull away, but it's not the kind of scary kind. It's a timeout kind, and I'm going to come back. Yeah, to the degree that you know, Norm and I just don't typically need that long of a timeout. You know, we just know... Like when I left the restaurant after the Dr. Whitney story, she knows I'm coming right back as soon as I kind of get my feet back on the ground. And you'll get a vibe of that once you do it some. But I think it's fine to say, let's revisit. There is the caveat of the people who are passive people or avoiders who will look at timeout as an opportunity to just never re-engage it. Okay? And with them, I might say to them, remember our first intervention with an unrepentant person, I would say, would you be willing to initiate when you're ready for us to get back to that issue? I don't want to nag. I don't want to badger you. I don't want to plead. I don't want to have the role of being the person who always initiates. But would you be willing to do that? I'd be really interested in what they would say about that. Would you be willing really creates an interesting circumstance for an avoider or somebody who's a perp. Next intervention would be to say, I noticed it's been a couple of days and you've never addressed this, and now here I am bringing it up again. I need a little space from you personally until you bring it up. I love you, but I really don't think I want to go to that office party tonight because it's just really not, I mean, there's this thing and you're never addressing it and I'm playing along and that just feels weird. That doesn't feel good to me. So you let me know when you want to talk about it, but I don't really feel like I can be real close to you until you do. In other words, we can start setting more limits. Okay? Let me do one of these. Yeah, this is a good one. Parenting question. This person's parents grew up in families that didn't share feelings. So this person grew up in family that didn't share feelings. They're seeing signs in the kids that the kids don't know how to share feelings. And you're a TCB-er. How do I break that cycle for my kids? I would say engage your kids about their feelings. But you're telling me that you can't engage feelings. So you don't know. But you're a TCB-er. But you're aware that your children aren't engaging feelings. That's interesting for a TCB-er to say. In other words, this is a TCB who has some emotional awareness. Ha! Gotcha! All right. So, all right. Remember what I said last night about how children are concrete thinkers and they're concrete feelers? So, one of the things I always like to do with kids anyway is the verb I made up is I want to help them mentalize their feelings. Okay? In other words, the more you can talk to a kid about what they're feeling, this isn't psychobabble. We're not saying, oh, Billy, I see you're very angry. Okay, we're not doing that. What we're doing is we're teaching them, like, you know, that's a cumulus cloud, and that's a brick building, and that's a sidewalk, and that's a stop sign, and this is letter A, and this is letter B, and that's anxiety, and that's anger, and that's a... We're teaching them the universe. This is taxonomy, all right? So I remember when one of mine was... It was Callie. She was three. We were at the grocery store, and she was sitting in the cart. You know, she put your legs in the cart. And the checkout lady... It's one of those where the checkout lady pulls the cart over onto her side of the little island, you know. So she pulls the cart over, and Callie's in the cart, and she's one of these big old, like, southern lady, and she's like, oh, aren't you a cute wood, like that, you know. And so Callie's like, and scrambles up out of the cart, and like koala style is up on my shoulder, you know, just going, so I whispered in her ear, I said, that lady scared you. Anyway, so we get home, mom's like, okay, how was the grocery? And Callie goes, a yay scared me. And I'm like, boom, all right? In other words, taxonomy, okay? So when you see your children experiencing emotional things, I just want to let that be part of the conversation. And even in your discipline, I really understand that your brother made you angry, but I can't let you hit him, okay? Or, you know, they say, look what I drew. I go, oh my gosh, that's awesome. It looks just like Spider-Man. God, I bet you're so proud of that. Don't say, I'm so proud of you. I don't care how you feel. I care about how they feel. I bet you're so proud. That feels so good to do that. Man, you are really brave to do that. So I was with some friends who have a little kid at a pizza restaurant where they, you know, make their own pizzas. And the little boy said he wanted some pizza dough. And he looks at me and he goes, I want some pizza dough to play with. And I said, well, go ask him. And he's like, what? I said, tell you what, let's you and me go ask him. And he goes, okay. And I said, do you want to talk to him? He's like, I said, okay, I tell you what we'll do this time. I'll talk to him, and then you can learn how I talk to him, and the next time you can talk to him. Because I know it's scary to talk to a man and ask for pizza dough. And he's like, okay. So we go up there, and I say, hey, Mr. Pizza Man. And the little boy goes, can I have some dough? I'm like, dude, that was so strong, man. You're like right up there. You're the Hulk. That's great. Okay? So in other words, that was a very emotionally laden, emotionally rich interaction about his anxiety, me teaching him about power, him stepping up with power, me saying, look, you are strong, that was scary, okay? You hear, I'm creating taxonomy for you. So you create a universe for your kids in which there's, which emotion is something you talk about, and even though you didn't grow up in a family that's like that, you're savvy enough about it to where you're noticing it missing in your kids, and your kids will start to develop more of that awareness. Now, flip side of that, as you're learning in the John Cox universe, it's a mighty thin dime that don't have two sides, we got to also talk about Desdemona, where every boo-boo is Hiroshima. Oh, no, my socks aren't on right. You know, and it's the end of the universe, okay? That kid doesn't need lots of, like, emotional focus and nurturing, okay? That kid needs more another thing kids need, which is more empowerment and grounding, which is kind of another part of kids. So in essence, kids need those same food groups. Actually, what I do in my parenting thing is I divide it into about seven of them. Anyway, so depending on your kid, you might need a different intervention. Fun question. All right, back to the floor. Y'all's turn. Yes, sir.
Going back to the timeout thing.
Yes.
Talking about 20 minutes. And I know there's not like a rule of thumb for that, mm-hmm. but can you talk a little more about brain chemistry or what's going on with that? Saying that at least as a minimum, maybe, or to kind of, I guess, let things work through and get to the frontal lobe that you're talking about, or I don't know.
Are you asking, like, talk more about the length of time or talk more about what needs to happen to get there?
Yeah, I think just the length of time, where that, because I think you said 20 minutes.
Well, physiologically, they say it takes 20 minutes. Sometimes all I need is to realize why that triggered me so much. And I'm like, ah, I get it. So, okay, all right, now I got my feet back on the ground. So I don't really know a time. Sometimes it takes a week,
yeah.
You know. What you need to be doing in that timeout is that bird's eye, what's going on with me question. Remember the two questions of bird's eye, what are we doing and what am I doing? Well, in your timeout, you need to be going, okay, wow. When I found out that Norma didn't bring wit, like she told me the other night, I said, I think I need to hang up and like process this. I hung up because I knew I was going to be ugly. And on the way home, I felt so angry. And I'm like, what's going on? Okay, I'm angry, which means I'm feeling something vulnerable, helpless, sad, disappointed. Okay. Now, remember the solutions to pain? Do I love her? She loved me? Yeah. Do I feel strong in me? Yeah. Can I be sad and grieve? Okay. Do your homework, John. And I got home and I wasn't triggered. All right. So you got to do that homework. Now, the better you are at that homework, the shorter your timeouts will be. Let's go back to the phone. How do you approach intimacy and conflict with a spouse who is suffering from anxiety and depression? That's very interesting. If you were local, I would ask you, talk to me about how that spouse's anxiety or depression gets in the way. What obstacles it creates. But let me just imagine some. So, here's a question I have. First question God always has when he encounters somebody who has a problem is, are they repentant or are they unrepentant? That's where he starts every time, because you go completely different directions. If this person has anxiety and depression and it just runs their life, if they're an anxious freak, you know, oh my gosh, you didn't wash your hands after, you know, and that's running their life. If they're kind of unrepentant in that position, you'd have to deal with it one way. If they say, God, yeah, baby, I struggle with so much anxiety and depression, and I know you want to be close, and I'm just hurting too much. That's a different story. Let's go with that one. With that person, all right, we got to ask one more question. Sorry. How much, okay, they don't want to be anxious and depressed. They're saying, Al, this is bad. I don't like it. I'm sorry it hurts our relationship. It hurts me all the time. Are they doing anything to address it? Some people will stay in anxiety and depression and not do anything about it. Let's say they are trying, but they're still stuck. All right, so here's the question. They're anxious, they're depressed. They don't want to be that way. They're doing as much as they can, and they're still stuck. All right, I think that is a place of sorrow together. I want a bruised reed, I do not break, kind of that story. I want to say, it's like my wife has been so down since her mom's sick. Remember my story this morning about, I said, how are you? And she said, I'm depressed. And I said, of course you are. Now, in that moment, we used her depression for greater intimacy. Go figure. That actually got us closer. So I wanna say to that person, I love you and your depression. I don't want your anxiety to control us, but I know it is such a burden for you. I don't know. If that person is genuinely anxious and depressed and doing all they can, I want to go with compassion there. But again, intimacy, that is intimacy. What I just did is intimacy. So what do you do with intimacy with that person? I've lost my wife in some ways because of this thing with her mom. It's really cost our marriage a lot. I need to be loving to her in that. That is intimacy right now in our relationship. You know? Being kind to her and how broken she is. There's also the question here of what do you do with conflict with somebody who's anxious and depressed? I wonder how that would corrupt the conflict, being anxious and depressed. I'm not sure how to answer that one. Y'all got thoughts on that one? Someone who's anxious and depressed and how that would interact with the conflict.
I think the scary part there is I'm assuming that you're worried that by raising the conflict, you're going to make them more anxious and depressed.
Ah.
That's what I'm assuming from the question.
Yeah, let's don't do that. I like that. In other words, is this person has a little codependency. Like, I'm going to take responsibility for making them more depressed by having my needs expressed. Don't do that. Okay? If your spouse is depressed and there's a real issue that needs to be addressed and they're really down and they stay really down and they're not willing to address it, I want to go, I know this is really hard for you, but I do need to matter here too, even in the midst of your depression. You can't cease to exist because of their stuff. All right? That's really very helpful. Thank you.
Well, we have someone in our life right now, their marriage is really struggling because one of the spouses is going through some massive depression and anxiety.
Yeah.
And not really seeking help. And I don't even know how to be there for them. You know, if that person was willing to get help, there's a lot that can be contributed.
Right.
But what do you do when that person's not even seeking treatment or help?
Right. And they won't listen to their spouse's confrontation about it. I'm probably at least going to go Matthew 18 on their hiney and pull in some elders or pull in some third parties and have best friends and people kind of go, dude, we're in your face.
It's getting bad quick.
Right,
and
yeah.
I'm really hurting for them, but I don't know until that person recognizes that they're part of the problem. They're blaming the other spouse.
Yeah.
And from the outside looking in, we're like...
Oh, does it have a marital dynamic to it?
A what?
A marital dynamic.
Oh, yes.
Okay, it's not just depression.
I mean, it's a depressed, anxiety-depressed person, spouse, in a marriage, obviously.
Right, and the marriage contributes to the
And they're
issues.
Throwing the
well,
D word around.
Well, the...
Okay.
The anxiety-depressed person is blaming the marriage for...
There you go. All right, there's your answer.
It's all the spouse's fault.
There you go. All right, well, I got your intervention then. You got to baby mobile that one. In other words, I'm depressed. It's all the marriage's fault. It's all your fault, but I'm not going to get help. Fine, cool. Send her to a good therapist. Let that therapist baby mobile her. And if she starts to shift the intervention, it'll change him.
Yeah.
Guaranteed. Almost. I actually made a bet with a woman once. I said... She said, this isn't going to work. I said, I'll bet you. I said, you give me, if this works, you bring me a gift card to so-and-so restaurant, and if it doesn't work, I'll give you a free session. I've only done that once. It's very unprofessional, but heck. Anyway, so one day she walks in a session, like, claps this gift card down and goes, happy now? I'm like, yeah, I am. Anyway, if she baby mobiles him, that's going to give a lot of power. That's what I would do. All right, yes, sir, in the back.
This isn't really kind of related. It's related to anxiety and depression. Just as okay. I've suffered with it for years. Sometimes, like, you can't...
Are you saying you've suffered with it for...
Right.
Okay, good.
It's all that you can do to lift your head. Like, you talk about seeking help. Like, you can't even... Like, just to exist is different. So, at that point, you need spouse, small group, whatever, maybe to kind of help boost you up, you know, like to reach out for you because you're unable to do that sometimes. So just, I feel like that needs to be entered into the conversation.
Let's enter it more. I really thank you. Would you be willing, and please say no, would you be willing to talk more about what that would look like and sound like and teach us?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, sometimes it's just like, hey, how's it going? Like that's, when, because my particular situation, it was, I mean, I'm not in the throes of it right now, you know, but it's always there, like some low grade. It's just there, but it's kind of one of those things people close to you, like, are willing to listen, but like, it takes everything I have to reach out, and when there's no, you know, after that engagement, you kind of need someone to check back in, you know?
Yeah.
And so just it's something as simple, this is just my personal experience. I don't speak for everyone who suffers.
You're giving us such a gift, thank you.
But, you know, I think that's what I'm saying is that like, you just don't have it in you, like to reach out sometimes, you know? And like, and sometimes that doesn't come across. Like you can't just look at someone and say, but yeah. So like, I guess what I'm saying is, on some level, one, there needs to be a willingness to be known and to know people on that level. And then also like to, because it's real easy to just, it's really difficult, I should say, if you don't struggle with that or if you've never been around, like to recognize it sometimes.
Yeah.
Or like to say, what do I do? Or if I talk about it, maybe that'll just make it worse kind of thing. At least for me, it doesn't. It shows like, man, I can't do it, you know?
Yeah. So you're reaching out right now. You are saying, hey, this is me. What is your name?
Carter,
thank you. And it's like for someone to reciprocate back, to remember that, to engage you, to say, we talked last week, how you been doing since I saw you?
Yeah, for sure. It's just a text, like, hey, how things been going? Like,
yeah.
It's nothing big. I mean, I don't have to sit, you don't have to sit down for like 3 hours at a time, like really,
right.
You know, be you, you know? Just
right.
Like, not every person can be your professional.
Right.
It's not. But I think that's important too, is like a lot of times, especially with mirrors, that first text question, like you got to have a third party. Like you can't, like that's too much for the spouse to take on. Like if it's not, I don't want to minimize circumstantial depression and anxiety because that's real and that's difficult. But if it's more of a fundamental biological thing as well, it's too much for spouse. Like it's too much for one best friend or a community group or whatever. Like it takes a village, you know. So,
and one of the things that touches your heart in that place is the recognition that, okay, maybe I'm not depressed right now. I have been though in my life, Carter, and I know what it feels like. I remember what it feels like, and for me to recognize, you know, Carter's still feeling that crap, and I care, and for somebody to reach back for you about that,
sure,
and to recognize that. That's a thing that feels healing to you. And that is, in a sense, bringing that into relationship and the relationship touching back. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Thank you. Yes, that's a very important balance to add to. I appreciate it. Anything else?
No.
Thank you, Carter. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
So.
Wait, let me make sure nobody else had one, since we've already given you a chance. Yeah, sorry.
How do you like resist the inner five-year-old in yourself during, because I know we've talked all about timeout, the inner five-year-old in yourself during that timeout to just like mount your argument? Not that I've ever done that. You know what I mean? Like, what's a tool? I mean, I've gone to therapy before and know that. Beauty of learning tools on how to deal with it. Like, what's a good trick or tool or something to kind of like instead of taking your time out and like going to your corners and like revving yourself up, how do you? And I know you mentioned being bird's eye, but are there other?
I tell you, you know, it's like a young lady last night had a question about being controlling, which I really appreciated. And you're talking about, you know, staying adversarial. I can tend to be a blow-upper. Like, you know, it's like if you don't get it after like my seventh try, you know, my limit's seven, and then I become a total jerk, right? Don't think you can resolve that yourself. In other words, remember what I said about out-of-control behavior is it always needs insight as to what's going on. Why am I needing to win so bad? But it also needs limits. In other words, so let's say you've mounted your argument. Your inner five-year-old's, that's all she's done in timeout. She's still triggered. And you come back and we say, okay, you ready to talk again? And you go, yeah, point one. Okay? What I hope your spouse will go is... Not going to do that. I'm not going to do the argument thing. If you've come already with an argument, I need time out again. That's not a kind of conversation I'm willing to have. Okay? In other words, we need a limit set on us. That's going to totally help us. Okay? You can't do that yourself. And it's really good if you can set those limits on yourself. If you told him, tell you what, if I come to you, hands on hips, little myth lawyer, then you shut me down. Don't let me go there. Out of control behaviors do not change unless you have a limit set. A couple of years ago, Norm and I went through a season where I would yell at her. We would have a little tiff in the night, and then you know, I have a great man cave, and I'd go watch a movie or something, man cave, and I'd come back downstairs, and she'd be like literally like getting ready for bed, in the bed, in her jammies, and I'd be like, and another thing, you know, like, she's just like, you know, like this dragon comes in the room, you know. So the next morning she says, that felt terrible, like you just came downstairs, I'm half asleep, and you let me have it, and I'm like, you know, you're right, that was terrible. Well, 2 weeks later, I did it again, you know. And she goes, you did that thing again. And I said, you know, you're right. I did. I really did. Well, two's the charm. And I know this. What I'm telling you is that an out-of-control behavior will never get better unless it costs you something. And I told her, I said, here's the deal. I do that again, I lose the man cave for a week. I'm down here watching Grey's Anatomy and stuff like that with you. You know? Fate worse than death. Well, lo and behold, I did it again. And she says, man cave? I'm like, yep. Okay. So I lost man cave for a week. I hated it. It was difficult. And I haven't yelled at her since.
So I said man cave?
Yeah. Here's the cure for anger, guys. 48-inch TV, remote control, surround sound, sailboat on the wall. It's awesome. Your anger just melts away. Now, I tell that story and a woman's going to go, oh, so it's not that you loved your wife, it's that you loved your man cave. Which is a wifey thing to say. Now, what wifey is missing is, no, the part of me that acts that way is a child. And children don't care about ultimate goodness. Telling a child you need to be kind to your wife because it's mean to yell at her and that hurts people, that's like telling your 8-year-old you need to go do your math homework because just think of all the people you'll help one day as a neurosurgeon. No, you need to take his Xbox, all right? So likewise, the inner child parts of us are children, and we need to go, you're going to lose your man cave if you mistreat your wife again, and you'll be amazed how that works. With any out of control behavior, you need to set limits. Overt, experiential limits if you can't control them. And you need to understand the innards too, but
two old ladies back.
Yeah, we're fighting back.
Here's
okay, what, can I say one thing?
Yeah, sure, because you're Patsy. You can do anything you want.
Have you been talking to my
husband?
I think the point needs to be made. You set that limit on yourself. Your wife did not set that limit on you. You said, if this happens again, then the consequence is going to be I lose my man cave for a week. That is very important piece of that puzzle.
Right.
That can't come from, I think that's an important piece of that puzzle.
Well, if the spouse is destructive and unrepentant, it can come from the other spouse, like the one who recorded the yelling and screaming in the car. In other words, she said, and he did have a titch of repentance in the sense that she said, I need help because you get out of control, and he was willing to do that. But let's say he didn't. I think, you know, she would ask me, well, what do I do if, you know, he yells at me in the car? I can leave the room if we're at home, but what about the car? And I said, well, maybe you need to take your own car up to the ball game and let him explain why you're not in his car. Or maybe you need to hold the phone up and record it. And what she ended up saying, and let's say he was unrepentant, I think it's legitimate to say, you aren't really willing to protect me in this, and so I kind of need some limits set on you. It's kind of like an alcoholic. And a limit is never a rule about you, it's a rule about me. You don't say to an alcoholic, quit drinking. You say, I don't interact with inebriated people. If you scream at me, I'm going to record it and call your best friend. That's a healthy, loving limit with somebody who's out of control. All right. So yes, we sometimes need to bring those. That's sort of the rebuke the unruly piece in the each other's in the New Testament. Out of control people need us to intervene on them sometime. But I think it's ideal if you can set it on yourself, like me in the man cave. But there is a space for that. Now that's not being maternal. I have had it with your drinking, and this is just going to stop. You know, that's being maternal. If you continue drinking, I don't feel comfortable going out to that party with you tonight. That's a good limit about me, all right? And then when I encounter the consequences of the choices I'm making, like my wife pulls away from me or my friends get in my face, that's that thing that makes an unrepentant person come and be a repentant person. That's how God turns unrepentant people into repentant people, by letting them face the consequences of their sin with people he loves. What does he do with people he doesn't love? Nothing. He gives them over. You know, there's C.S. Lewis said there are two kind of people in the world. Those who say to God, thy will be done, and those to whom God says, thy will be done. All right? And so with people he loves, he gets in their face. So that's why we set those limits. Yes?
Well, and that was a segue just into my question of, I mean, the skills have been so great that you talked about today, and it just makes me go back to last night thinking about the underlying thing of humility and repentance,
mm-hmm.
because I know when I'm wanting to win, I'm not humble, I'm not repentant. So I just wanted to know if you would go back around to that, which you kind of started to do, and talk about, because we could do all the steps,
right.
and actually be proud that, you know, hey, look at me, I'm doing it, you know. But I'm not humble, and I'm not repentant, and I'm not vulnerable, and I'm not wanting the best for you. I'm just wanting to get it down, because that's kind of my personality. Like, tell me what to do, and I'm going to make an A, you know. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask if you'd talk more about humility and repentance.
What part about it? Help me out. How to get humble? Help me a little more.
Maybe the trust factor in all
of
it.
Uh-huh. Okay. You know, I got a guy right now and a couple, and he gets really volatile when she talks about anything he does that she doesn't like. He has no room for her to point out his flaws. And you might say he's not humble. But one of the things that goes on for him is his little inner five-year-old is not a jerk. His little inner five-year-old is afraid of shame. His little inner five-year-old doesn't have a category that it could possibly be okay for him to be screwed up. What are you talking about? That's never happened in his life. And so one of the things that I've been playing with him and having him play with, but I play with it too, I tease him about it some, is his wife will say things that she disagrees with or that feel bad from him, and he'll start to get defensive, and I'll stop him and go, wait, let's ask your wife if she loves you, loves you, loves you, even though she disagrees with this thing about you. Because that's your question. Does she still love you? Do you still have respect for me? Do you still think I'm a cool guy? Do you still want me, even though I'm a knucklehead and I did this wrong? And in other words, we've been playing with this shame. One of the obstacles to being humble, I mean, if you want to be humble, that's easy. Tell the truth. John's magic cure. You tell the truth everywhere you go, you'll be humbled by 6 tonight. I promise you, all right? Call me and tell me when it happens, all right? That's easy. Humble's easy. But most of us can't do that because there's so much shame involved. So if I have trouble being humble, there's often a piece that's hurt. There's a piece that feels shameful, that doesn't feel safe. You use that word. I like that. So so if we think about trying to be humble, an obstacle to that is going to be, do you still want me if I admit to you I'm screwed up? Can I say to my wife, I can't control my anger, and I need my man cave taken away from me? Yeah, my own narcissism wanted Dr. Whitney to think I'm the bomb. You're right. Now, that's humiliating, okay? But do y'all still love me even though I screwed up with Dr. Whitney? Thank y'all. Body of Christ. Great. All right. See, I have eyes just say, we love you even though you're screwed up, John. Okay, we had a guy do a marriage conference and he screwed up like us. Awesome. That's love. All right. Now, what we do when we feel shame is we trade in love for adoration. I want y'all to think I'm amazing. Okay? Now, that's all I'll ever get. That's as deep as it'll ever go. You'll think I'm amazing and I won't feel shame, but I won't feel loved. I won't feel y'all. I won't leave here going, God, that was great to be with those people. because I wouldn't have been with you. You'd have been with my representative. All right? So as we look at humility, let's also look at what we do with shame. And if you have trouble being repentant, sometimes it's because somewhere you learned it wasn't safe. And you need those eyes that can see your fallenness and don't fall to feel like, gosh, it's really safe for me to be screwed up and for me to say, yeah, honey, you're right. You're right. It's not the whole story. You have a part in it too, but you're right about that. That takes a lot of safety. Now, that's an interesting thing just to talk about, again, in your marriages. This is under the can I forgive me, can I forgive you category. If I can't hold forgiveness in my heart, then it's going to be really hard for me to be humble. That's a really very interesting question. All right, I want to be respectful of time, boss. You tell me what you want.
We got a few more minutes. We started a little late here.
Okay, good.
I mean,
all right, let's check the phone. Regarding a win-win commitment, what if one party does not think that the other spouse's need is okay? In other words, it's not just they disagree with it. They might consider it a sinful desire or something they're making an idol out of. That's very interesting. That's actually a really good point. I think may ought to put that in the talk. When we are talking about needs, you know, our culture is all about what you need. When we were talking about the four food groups last night of your abilities, those really are basically the only real needs that we have. To be loved, to have identity, to have forgiveness, and to be able to manage my emotional world. And your distinction here between a need and an envious desire is very accurate. You know, I need a Jaguar E-Type. You know, I really do. No, that's not really a need. So, you encounter them wanting something, and you feel like it's actually something hurtful to them. First question, always, how repentant are they? In other words, this is something I really want. I really want that golf club membership. And it's going to cost our family a lot, and it's going to cause some problems and some limitations, and I really need it. And you feel like, God, that's really a costly desire. And are they open? Are they open to win-win too? In other words, regarding this win-win commitment question, if they're as open to win-win as you are, then they're willing to listen to you and investigate whether this is an envious desire or an idol. Okay? So let's play it out. First, they're open. You go, I got real concerns about this because I think if we give in and you get this, I don't think it's good for you and I think it's bad for you. And they say, I disagree with you. I don't think it's that. But I'm willing to talk to my buddies about it. I'm willing to talk to Brian and Steve about it. And how about that? Win-win. In other words, you're willing to let me consider this. I'm willing to talk to some of the guys who got good eyes on me. How about that? Now there's your win-win. All right? So we hadn't landed on the golf club membership yet, but we've landed on the fact that we're going to have some deep consideration about this issue. Okay? And some third parties. Just can't get around third parties. I mean, think. The term self-help is an oxymoron, all right? But focus on moron, all right? I mean, I'm the last person I want helping me. Thank you very much, all right? I want somebody else's eyes. So when you get to some of the stuck places, now let's say that person was unrepentant and they're like, you know, well, all I do for this family, I deserve a golf membership if I want one. That person's not playing win-win at all, so we got to go a different direction with them. I'm not sure what direction to go with that. Basically, that person's kind of just thumbing their nose at you. And what you want in the marriage doesn't matter at that point. I'm not going to fight. I'm going to say, you're pulling a power move. I'm going to be a psychological mirror. That's what I'm going to do. I want to speak some truth to this unrepentant jerk. You are pulling a power move. You are saying over my dead body, you are going to make this thing happen. And I'm got to tell you that that is going to harm me. and it's going to harm us. And I really want to ask you to reconsider to do it. It's going to create pain. Please. I want to start there. I want to say, here's a mirror of what's going to happen. That's how God often begins his interventions, is by going, if you do this, the day you do it, you'll truly die. Now, he doesn't say, don't do it. He says, the day you'll eat of this, you'll truly die. He kind of lets you do the math, okay? So first step with an unrepentant jerk is, I want to hold a mirror up and go, that's going to cost me and you. It's going to harm me to do that. I had a woman who was working with a jerky, dealing with a jerky husband, and we were working, and she came up with this one. She told him, she said, every time you treat me that way, I can't stop you and I can't control you, but I feel part of me pull further and further away from you. That's not a threat. That's just information. This is the consequence. You spend a dollar, you have a dollar less. I didn't make that up. You treat people like that and it costs them in the universe. And if you're dealing with somebody who's so unrepentant that they're just going to drive home this envious desire on top of you, I want to at least begin by saying, I'm not going to fight you, I'm not going to roll over. But I'm also not going to be a shrew. I'm going to tell you the truth. This is going to cost us. And ultimately, you might need to get somebody in here to help us with it. I'm asking you to please. I want to do that first. I think I'll just leave that there right now. Question here.
We probably should shut it down. I forgot about child care.
Oh, children.
Yeah, Jeanette's not here to remind me of that.
All right. Yeah. I'm going to pray. Is that all right?
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
Father, in situations like this, I'm reminded of who you are. You know, for us to reach wisdom, for us to reach understanding, we have to like scratch our heads and raise our hands and, you know, do PowerPoints and work really hard to find wisdom. And you don't. You just are, and it is truth. You move, and it is goodness and wisdom and righteousness. You know all of what is true. You are truth. And you are love. And we worship you for that. As we have spent the morning working to try to become more like you, we worship that you are you. Effortlessly holy, effortlessly righteous and wise. You are our God. And you are the heart of our marriages. And we pray, again as we did last night, that you would baptize our hearts and our marriages with your Holy Spirit. That would be a place of growth. We pray this in the name of Christ. Amen. Amen. Thank you, my friends.
Thank you. A couple quick things. One is our hope as elders with this, doing this conference, is that this would be a conversation starter. Not just for y'all in your marriages,